Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is June 15th, 2018, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Haven't Got Time for the Pain. What about IV lidocaine? And our guest skeptics is Dr. Sergey Motov. Sergey is an emergency physician in the Department of Emergency Medicine in Maimonides Medical Center in New York City. And our second guest is Lucas Silva. He is a fifth-year medical student from Brazil. They do six-year programs in Latin America. He's also a former research fellow in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Welcome back to the SGEM, Sergey.
Thank you so much for inviting me back. Honored and excited to be back on the show.
Well, you know, I think you are a rock star, and it's not just me. I think a lot of people think you are the rock star in the world of ED pain management.
Well, you are giving me too much credit. I'm not a rock star. I'm just a mere servant to a world of immersive medicine.
Well, your paper on ceiling dose for ketorolac has changed my practice. It's knowledge translation in action. No longer am I giving 30 milligrams IV, but rather using 10 to 15 milligrams.
Well, that just brightened my heart. Thanks for making my day. Validation of any scientific concept, and specifically research that conducted by our colleagues and myself included, makes me very, very happy. So thanks for telling me this.
Well, you're making me a better emergency physician. And welcome to Lucas.
Hey, Ken. Thank you for inviting me to participate in the show. Since I joined the FOAM Award a few years ago, I had the dream of participating in your podcast. So I'm very happy to be here today to discuss one of my research projects. It's an honor to discuss some evidence-based medicine with you and Sergey.
When we get together in person, I'm going to suggest you come up with some other dreams, okay? I got to ask you this, though, Lucas. How did you get mixed up with a guy like Sergey?
So when I started to write a protocol for this systematic review that we're going to discuss later on, I had a meeting with my supervisors, Dr. Fernanda Belolio and Dr. Daniel Cabrera, and we knew that would be really important to have someone in our team with a high level of expertise in pain management in the emergency department. And, you know, Ken, at that moment, we couldn't think of any other person besides Sergey. He's a rock star, as you already said. So we invited him to join the team, and that's how we got involved. It's such a great honor to work with him on this project.
Very kind of you. Thank you so much.
You are a rock star. North America, South America, and all over the world. All right, come on, guys. Enough self-congratulating. Let's get on to a case. Who's going to give me the case? Is it going to be you, Lucas, or is it going to be Sergey that's going to read out the case?
I can do that.
Sounds good.
So a 42-year-old man presents to the emergency department with chief complaint of severe right flank pain that radiates to his groin of 3 hours duration. The patient also reports nausea, increasing frequency on urination, and blunting his urine. His writing pain on a physical examination, he was noted to have a severe right flank tenderness to palpation and tenderness at right costal vertebral angle. You entertain the clinical diagnosis of renal colic and proceed with ordering 10 milligrams of intravenous ketorolac. On reassessment at 20 minutes post-analgesia, the patient is still complaining of moderate degree of pain and states that morphine worked well in the past. But he is wondering if you can take off his pain without an opioid. While contemplating your next analgesic choice, you suddenly remember listening to a podcast that discussed the role of intravenous lidocaine in managing pain of renal colic origin, SGM 202. You reassure the patient that you check on the feasibility of other non-opioid analgesics, but at the same time, you decide to quickly review available data on IV lidocaine for utility on acute pain in the emergency department.
Well, pain is one of the most common, if not the most common, reason patients present to the emergency department. Physicians have many pharmacological and non-pharmacological ways to provide safe and effective pain control.
Anesthetics agents like lidocaine that targeted sodium channels are widely used in the emergency departments for topical and local anesthesia. Lidocaine is a local anesthetic agent with analgesic, anti-hyperalgesic, and anti-inflammatory properties. It has a short life, about 60 to up to 120 minutes, with often predictable and short-lived adverse effects. It has been suggested that intravenous lidocaine could be an alternative for pain control instead of opioids or NSAIDs. This would be when these other treatment modalities have been ineffective or associated with severe degree of adverse effects.
We have looked at IV lidocaine for the treatment of renal colic on SGEM 202. The SGEM bottom line from that episode was that lidocaine cannot be recommended for the treatment of renal colic. All right, Sergey, I understand you're going to give the clinical question.
I'd love to. So the clinical question as such, is administration of intravenous lidocaine safe and effective in managing patients presenting to the emergency department with acute or chronic pain?
And for the reference, I'm going to get Lucas to do that because your name is first. You're the lead author on this paper.
Sounds perfect, Ken. So the title is Safety and Efficacy of Intravenous Lidocaine for Pain Management in the Emergency Department, a Systematic Review, published in Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2018.
And if I forget to say it later, congratulations as a medical student getting published in Annals of Emergency Medicine. Well done, Lucas.
Thank you so much, Ken.
All right, Sergey, let's run through the PICOs. And if you noticed, I said PICOs because we're adding an S. Not that there's more than one PICO, but it's going to stand for the population, intervention, comparison, outcomes. But the last thing, we're adding study design. So give us the population.
Studies of adult patients greater than 17 years of age who received at least one dose of intravenous lidocaine in the emergency department for their management of acute or chronic pain were included.
And for exclusions, it was studies in which patients received IV lidocaine in a setting outside the emergency department or for indications other than analgesia. Studies that used lidocaine for regional anesthesia, like a beer block, were also not included. What was the intervention?
Intravenous lidocaine given in the emergency department.
And what did they compare it to?
They had two controls, active controls, which included either opioid or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent, or placebo.
And let's run through their outcomes. They had efficacy outcomes.
Efficacy outcomes evolved around a reduction in pain scores through visual analog scale or any other pain assessment tool and a need for rescue analgesia.
And what did they have for safety outcomes?
Safety outcomes included incidence of adverse drug reactions, both overall and separated into non-serious, for example, dizziness, or serious, for example, cardiac arrest categories.
And this was a systematic review, and part of that systematic review was to look at risk of bias.
Authors used the Cochrane Collaboration Bias Appraisal Tool for the randomized control trials and a modified Newcastle-Ottawa scale tool for observational studies.
And they also assessed the certainty.
Yes. The certainty for each outcome was evaluated with a grading of recommendations assessment, development, and evaluation, as we all know, called GRADE methods.
And now we've got to the S of this PICOs. So what was the study design?
Study design, authors included original research articles that included randomized control trials and observational studies. Case reports were excluded.
All right, it's time to give the author's conclusions. So as the lead author, Lucas, what were your conclusions?
Okay, there is limited current evidence to define the role of intravenous lidocaine as an analgesic for patients with acute renal colic and critical limb ischemia pain in the emergency department. Its efficacy for other indications has not been adequately tested. The safety of lidocaine for emergency department pain management has not been adequately examined.
All right, so we're going to go through the quality checklist for therapeutic systematic reviews, and it has 7 questions. And Lucas, I believe you're going to do this. So let's start with question number 1, the clinical question. Is it answerable and sensible?
Unsure. It may be too broad for a systematic review, given it has included all causes of pain.
The search for the studies, was it detailed and exhaustive?
Yes. We used 3 large electronic databases, gray literature, and also ongoing trials were searched with almost 2,000 titles screened.
The third question, the primary studies, were they of high methodological quality?
We're going to say no. Among the randomized controlled trials, only 2 studies had overall low risk of bias, and all observational studies had high risk of bias.
The assessment of the studies were reproducible?
Yes.
Were the outcomes clinically relevant?
We're going to say yes.
Was there low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcome?
So this is not applicable. The paucity of studies in the ED setting, the significant clinical heterogeneity, and the limited quality of evidence actually prevented us from performing a meta-analysis.
All right, the seventh and final question. The treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
We're going to say not applicable as well. Meta-analysis was not performed, and the results of the studies were reported individually.
Well, let's go through the results. You did mention you searched almost 2,000 titles, which were screened for inclusion, with 61 articles getting the full text review. 8 studies met the inclusion-exclusion criteria, and that was 6 randomized control trials and 2 case series for a total of just over 500 patients. The causes of pain included limb ischemia, migraine headaches, radicular low back pain, and renal colic. But let's go through the outcomes. The first thing was efficacy.
So for the efficacy outcomes, there were 6 randomized control trials included and 2 case series. Among the 6 randomized control trials, IV lidocaine had efficacy equivalent to that of active controls in 2 studies and was better than active controls in 2 other studies. In particular, IV lidocaine had pain score reduction comparable to or higher than that of intravenous morphine for pain associated with renal colic and critical limb ischemia. Lidocaine did not appear to be effective for migraine headache in 2 studies.
How about the safety?
So there were 20 adverse events reported by 6 studies among 225 patients who received intravenous lidocaine in the emergency department, being 19 non-serious adverse events and 1 serious adverse event.
And then we also had the risk of bias and certainty of the evidence. And under the risk of bias, the overall risk of bias in the studies, 3 of them were unclear, 3 of them had high risk of overall bias, and only 2 studies had low risk of overall bias. And then when they looked at the certainty of the evidence, the 3 questions, the reduction in pain scores, very low certainty. Need for rescue analgesia, again, very low certainty. And finally, the incidence of adverse events, very low certainty. But it's time to talk nerdy to me, my favorite section. Are you gentlemen ready to go?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, here we go. First question is about search strategy. This was an excellent example of how to do a good search. Can someone, either Lucas or Sergey, explain what you did so others do a good search who are interested in doing a systematic review?
I can do that. So that's actually a great discussion point, Ken. Regarding the search strategy, we fortunately had the help of an amazing medical librarian. I know that lots of institutions don't have this resource, but people who do systematic reviews really should consider having one as part of their research team. Medical librarians have the expertise to do the right search strategy for the right database based on your PICO question of your systematic review. And in our search strategy, we also use few resources that people often forget when doing the search for systematic reviews. The gray literature, for example. If you look at the Cochrane Handbook, which is a free online resource, they say that there are many definitions of gray literature, but it's usually understood as the literature that is not formally published in sources such as books or journal articles. And the Cochrane Handbook actually helps you in order to look for this gray literature. But Ken, why is it important to look for this? So there's a Cochrane methodology review from 2007 showing that published trials have an overall greater treatment effect than the trials coming from the gray literature. So not looking for these studies may actually affect the results of your systematic review. And, you know, it's also really important to look for ongoing trials. We fortunately have the clinicaltrials.gov, which is also free online resources, and where we can see what trials are upcoming, and actually you often see completed trials that are not published yet. You know, I think this is an opportunity to contact the authors looking for their results, or at least knowing when they're going to publish in order to include in your systematic review. And you guys would actually be surprised how collaborative the research community can be. So I really encourage people to look for not published results and contact the authors in order to get more data to include in systematic reviews.
Well, you mentioned clinicaltrials.gov. That is one of my favorite sites to go and look for ongoing research, or once research is published, to check to see if the primary outcome matches the primary outcome that was originally planned. The other thing you did, Lucas, though, is there were no language restrictions. And I don't know if that's because you had a Brazilian and a Russian and some Americans on board, but you had no language restrictions. And I think that's great not to think that all medical research needs to be published in English. But let's move on to the second nerdy thing I wanted to talk about. And that was about combining studies. Why did you include two case series, which are observational studies, in the systematic review? These are lower forms of evidence and can only conclude associations.
Ken, this is not a really good question. When we started this project and defined our PICO question for the systematic review, we thought that the body of evidence for IV lidocaine in pain control wouldn't be large out there. So we thought that including observational studies would give us a better sense of the whole body of evidence on this topic. And I feel although observational studies can only show associations, and we know that they are not the best type of study design, they often can give us information that will help us with future better design research. And another rationale that we have used for including observational studies is that they provide additional data for adverse events, which was one of the outcomes that we are looking at. And, you know, that's especially true when you know that there are only few randomized trials out there. So I like the idea of including the whole body of evidence when doing a systematic review of, I'm going to call, brand new topics, so the future researchers can have a better idea of what we have so far, regardless of the study design. And besides that, I really want to mention that it's really important when you include observational studies in your systematic review to address their quality. And, you know, in this systematic review, we saw that all observational studies were really of poor quality. And I think that's an important message for the readers, saying that please take care when looking at these results because they are very susceptible for bias.
Well, I do like the fact that you focused in on adverse events, though, because it is a bias of not reporting adverse events. We know that that bias exists and adverse events are systematically not reported. So it's really important that combining those studies, including observational studies, you are also trying to get at adverse events. The third nerdy point I wanted to talk about was the quality of the evidence. The quality of the evidence was low due to methodological problems, the risk of bias, inconsistencies, small studies, and imprecision. There was so much heterogeneity, different pain conditions, lidocaine doses, outcome measures, that you were not able to perform a meta-analysis. So what value do you think just a systematic review without a meta-analysis has to clinicians, people on the front lines, providing care?
First of all, I think it's worth mentioning the difference between a narrative review and a systematic review. Narrative, traditional, unstructured review articles are useful for obtaining a broad overview of a clinical condition, but they may not provide a reliable and unbiased answer to a focused question. On the other hand, systematic reviews as this one are research summaries that address a focused clinical question in a structured and reproducible manner, following specific guidelines for methodology. And another important point that I want to make here is that systematic reviews are often, but not always, followed by a meta-analysis, which is the statistical pooling or aggregation of results from different studies, providing a single summary effect estimate. And when you start a systematic review, you can plan all the meta-analysis part, but you can't actually predict if you're going to actually be able to perform one. So it's really important to say that meta-analysis will be the last part of a systematic review, and the decision to whether or not combining the results is quite challenging. After saying that and answering your question more specifically, Ken, I think systematic reviews, even without a meta-analysis, are the way to go to find out what is the current body of evidence for that specific question. And there are several benefits of performing this type of review, including the fact that the clinician in the front line won't have the time to review all studies individually. So the systematic review can provide a good summary of what is out there about the topic in the last unbiased way possible. And last but not least, I think this type of review may be even more useful for policymakers or researchers, meaning that they show what is the current state of the art for that specific question. And in this case, we're seeing a very low quality of body of evidence and also several gaps in this specific literature. So to conclude, systematic reviews, even without meta-analysis, will be very helpful to inform medical decision-making process, plan future research agendas, and establish clinical policies of medical societies in an evidence-based way.
Well, I like the fact that you talked about systematic reviews and you said that they had clinical value to clinicians, because clinicians listen to this show. But I also like the fact that you didn't go ahead and do the meta-analysis, because one of my pet peeves is when I see a systematic review that's been done and then they meta-analyze the data and they get the heterogeneity, the I-squared test of 97%. And I'm like, oh, these are not apples and oranges. These are like apples and fish you're trying to put together. I mean, really, these are not the same. So I'm glad that you didn't go ahead and try to force a meta-analysis on something that had such great heterogeneity and that it has clinical value. Let's move on to the fourth nerdy point, and that's about the hierarchy of evidence. And this is something that's bantered around the EBM world, because there's this pyramid of evidence for evidence-based medicine. And on the bottom is background information and expert opinion. And all the way up at the top is the systematic review. However, in this case, when the quality of evidence is so poor, I would suggest that a well-done randomized control trial gets us closer to the quote-unquote truth than a number of low-quality randomized control trials and observational trials mashed up into a meta-analysis or systematic review.
I agree with you, Ken. I still believe and agree with what Lucas said, that systematic reviews are probably likely so and deservedly so on top of the pyramid. But well-done randomized controlled trials with very narrow question, properly designed trial, addressing all the possible biases would give us a better idea and better quality of data than low quality that included in systematic reviews and meta-analysis.
And Ken, we have to remember that, you know, systematic reviews is garbage in, garbage out.
Now, how do you say that in Portuguese?
Lixo para dentro, lixo para fora.
There we go. Oh, it's knowledge translation in multiple languages. I love it. Okay, fifth and final nerdy point. And this is, where do we go from here? I mean, you guys are both pain researchers. Where do we go from here? What studies would you suggest to address the insufficient evidence we have to answer the question on whether or not IV lidocaine is safe and effective for pain control in the emergency department?
Well, I'm probably going to start with this. And I am looking, and I'm supporting, and I'm encouraging researchers across the world who's listening to this podcast and beyond, if you do consider using intravenous lidocaine, execute cautious optimism, obviously, by listening to this podcast. But if you do want to make a change in the way we proceeding with this medication, well-crafted, well-randomized control trial that may involve two arms, even three arms, that will broaden the inclusion criteria, because most of the RCTs and some of the observational studies in this systematic review cut patients off who were 65 and older. So including patient with pre-existing cardiac disease or even any arrhythmias, that will give us actual sample of the population that we see on every daily basis in our emergency department, would be beneficial to this type of studies. So randomized controlled trials, broad inclusion criteria, probably executed with the minimum risk of biases.
Ken, it's impossible to disagree with Sergey, right?
It is impossible to disagree with Sergey. But you know who's going to agree with Sergey very strongly is Captain Cranium himself, Chris Carpenter, that geriatric EM guru, who's going to love hearing the fact that you don't want to exclude people over the age of 65, because we need more information as we are going to be treating more and more of those people in our emergency departments. Well, that's it for the nerdy questions, but now we're going to come to the comment on the author's conclusions and compare to the SGEM's conclusions. And I can't really ask the two of you guys because you're the authors, so here we go. Here's what I'm going to say. I agree with the author's conclusions that this systematic review of limited, highly heterogeneous, low-quality evidence does not support a routine administration of IV lidocaine to manage pain of renal colic or critical limb ischemia in the emergency department. And so the SGEM bottom line is, the current available evidence is not strong enough to support the routine use of IV lidocaine for analgesia in the emergency department. And Sergey, can you give us a case resolution?
Sure. You proceeded with ordering intravenous morphine with nearly complete resolution of pain while patient was in the ED. Subsequently, you were able to discharge this patient home with a follow-up with urology.
And how about the clinical application, Sergey?
The clinical utility of intravenous lidocaine for managing acute pain in the emergency department is yet to be determined. By conducting a more robust research with a broader inclusion criteria, as I mentioned earlier, elderly patient with pre-existing cardiac and arrhythmogenic disease and pain syndromes. However, which is my biggest stipulation to it, on case-by-case basis, in the situation when either opioids or NSAIDs are contraindicated or intolerable or unsuitable for patients, intravenous lidocaine might, and that's the key word, might be considered for pain control in the ED.
And you know, I was taught when anybody said may, you could substitute may not, but that also applies to might and might not. But that's okay. So what are you going to tell your patient at the bedside?
Well, that's a tricky one. So I would approach the patient and tell, one of the non-opioid analgesics that I was considering ordering for you doesn't have good evidential support for its pain relief and safety in the ED. Therefore, I will take conventional and probably safer approach at this time. I'm going to write her up for intravenous morphine.
Last week's winner was David Lemonick. Again, he knew a systolic blood pressure less than 100 was a reason to stop the procainamide infusion as part of the Ottawa Aggressive Protocol for atrial fibrillation. All right, so I have a Brazilian, a Russian, and a Canadian on this show, and it is the World Cup that is going on. So normally we have a Keener contest, a trivia contest question that revolves around something to do with the episode. But with the World Cup going on, we thought we should come up with a World Cup question. And I don't know if you guys just heard, but North America was just awarded the 2026 World Cup. So that'll be Canada, US, and Mexico. So one of you has to give me a World Cup trivia question, a World Cup Keener contest. So if there are Keeners out there that are World Cup fans, what's the question?
Lucas, I think you should go ahead and do it because it looks like Brazil is probably going to dominate again. So on behalf of your country and your team, why don't you go ahead?
So the Keener question for this week is, how much money superstar Portuguese Cristiano Ronaldo fined for tax evasion this morning?
Oh, yes, he was fined for tax evasion. Now, we want the amount in euros, not American dollars, euros. So how much was he fined for tax evasion today in euros? And if you know the answer, then send it to the sgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Maybe I should take some predictions from you guys, though. Who do you think is going to win the World Cup? Sergey, start with you.
Brazil.
Okay, and I'm going to say Canada will not. Lucas, who do you think is going to win?
Absolutely Brazil. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Sergey, for coming back on the SGEM and talking about pain.
Thanks, Ken, for having me. Always enjoy doing the podcast with you.
And congratulations to you, Lucas, for doing the research, getting it published, and then, of course, coming on the SGEM to discuss it with us today.
Thank you, Ken. It was really awesome to participate in the show. I really hope to continue the collaboration with you and Sergey. And congratulations for all your amazing work to cut the knowledge translation window. Thank you very much.
Well, as you know, the guest skeptic gets to read the SGEM tagline. So I will give you the opportunity to either read it in English with a really thick accent, or you can read it in Portuguese.
Okay, what about both?
That would be wonderful.
So first in English. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Lembre-se de duvidar de tudo que você aprende, mesmo que você escute no Guia do Médico Emergencista Cético.
Talk to everyone next week.